All right, episode 12 today.
Oh, we're moving right along with the season.
We are. Welcome to Coffee with Crime, everyone. I'm Lewis.
And I'm Alexi.
And thank you for listening. Christmas is coming up, and one gift that we are happy to have is your listening and enjoying this show, and it kind of keeps us cranking episodes out. So Thank you for doing that, and we truly hope everyone has a wonderful holiday season. And we have a holiday blend today that I am bringing to you. We have, and I meant to try this place a lot earlier, but I just never got around to it till now. But because this is our one thing I wanted to mention too. Speaking of listeners, we just hit our 3,000 listen mark on our podcast. So that's like a milestone for us.
This is cool too. We have listeners in 12 different countries.
Wow, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
And another plug for Anchor.fm. It's a free app that allows you to record your own podcasts and release them to literally every streaming, you know, service. It's really cool. So that's what enables us to see like countries and listeners and all that stuff. So yeah, 12 different countries. That's really neat.
It's very interesting. Yeah. I wonder if part of that is like we've done a lot of crimes from other countries, and usually I'll tag it.
Okay.
So I wonder if people look for crime and like here, and I don't know.
That must be
it. It's cool though, whatever it is.
So today we have a holiday blend, and we don't usually do holiday, or we don't usually do blends, as many of you know. We usually focus on single origins and just try to taste the flavor of whatever specific country. But holiday blends are a big part of the coffee industry. I actually do have the countries that this is blended from. But this is from Dunn Brothers Coffee. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about the company first. It is probably going to be familiar to a lot of people. They originated in Minneapolis. But it's a very interesting model that they have as a coffee shop. So in the 1980s, Ed and Dan Dunn.
Are they brothers?
They're brothers. They're the Dunn brothers. And they moved, they had some coffee experience that they got in Portland, Oregon in the early 1980s. And the website didn't give a huge story on it, but for whatever reason, they moved to Minneapolis. They took their coffee experience with them, and they started a coffee shop with the goal of roasting in small batches, serving coffee as fresh as possible right to the customer over the counter, providing a warm coffee experience in the cafe, and putting local community first as a priority, as the core of the business. So that was their goal. And in 1987, Dunn Brothers Coffee was born. They started their first coffee shop, and it quickly grew into something that I don't know if there are locations in other countries, but I know for sure in the Midwest here, you see them a lot in Minnesota.
Right.
Iowa, here on the Iowa side of the river. I don't know if we have any in Illinois. I really don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know that I've ever seen any in the Chicagoland area, now that I come to think of it. So, yeah, having originated in Minneapolis, you can see why it would be in Iowa. So they started the coffee shop, and they've really carried the community aspect with the brand to the point where almost every single location is independently owned and operated. It's not just a branch of the main place.
So it's like a franchise.
It's a franchise. It's very largely franchise driven. There might be, you know, I think there's a smattering of a couple that are low, you know, maybe they're in airports or something like that.
Right.
But almost every Dunn Brothers location is a independently owned and operated local franchise with roasters right inside. And that's a core value of Dunn Brothers, is that they put a heavy emphasis on, they don't just want to be roasting in Minneapolis and sending out bags that get 1, 2, 3 weeks old. They want it to be really fresh and in accordance with that original value, that goal that they had when they started. And so, yeah, right when you walk in this morning, I went to the Dunn Brothers location right on Middle Road in the Duck Creek area of Davenport. And this awesome aroma of freshly roasted coffee just hits you in the face. Like, it's really, and every time you walk in, and it, you know, they're not putting little scent packs around. It's like they're just always roasting coffee. And what actually happens with coffee, and I've talked about it before, I have roasted it. When you roast it, the actual smell is not a coffee smell at all. It smells like toast or mm-hmm. burnt pizza or something like that. But they have a chimney basically that goes right, you know, and that brings that smell out into the air, so that you're not smelling this weird burning smell all the time. But what happens after you roast coffee is it starts to release, I think, CO2, and there's this scent, that there's this aroma that comes along with that. So they roast it, they put it in the bags, and the bags just emit the smell. I mean, I've had freshly roasted coffee in my car before, and I'll leave my car and I'll come back and I'm like, oh my gosh, it smells like a coffee shop in here. Just 1 pound of coffee, it'll emit so much aroma. So yeah, when you walk into a Dun Brothers, it smells like coffee because you're smelling constantly smelling coffee that's freshly been roasted. And just the environment, the atmosphere. I mean, it is a sacrifice in floor space to have those roasters right up front, but they kind of want to show like, hey, this is what we're doing all the time.
Yeah.
And another thing I'll say, as far as putting the community first, you know, instead of giving some sort of soundbite from the website, I was roasting coffee for a friend, kind of on an experimental basis, but I have a friend who was doing agricultural and educational development in Cameroon in Africa. Mm-hmm. And he was sending me coffee that the students in the program were involved with and growing. And so he was trying to roast, he's trying to roast it and see how it tasted. And he sent me so much. For me, I had this 1 pound roaster, and he sent me like 70 pounds one time. And it was taking me like an hour because I was taking notes and I was being really meticulous with it. And I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do with 70 pounds? So I go over to Dun Brothers because I saw their big roasters and I knew that they had that capability. And I said, hey, what would you charge for? I got to roast this. And I you know what you're doing more than I do. And I just want to see how this tastes. And I also have some friends that want to buy it, but I just don't have the time to do 70 pounds. And they said, we'll do it for free.
What?
They just roasted it and then they gave it to me, no charge. So that's like real life community involvement.
That's cool. I don't think I've ever heard that.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I've always appreciated the fact that they were able to just do that for free.
That's super nice.
Yeah, and the Cameroon coffee roasting thing just didn't work out for me because on a practical, I was going full time with music and I didn't have time. So they're actually roasting it in Cameroon now, which is really cool. And just selling it there. But yeah, so Dun Brothers, very interesting model that they have. It's really unlike anything else because on one hand, it is it's a national brand. I mean, it's a franchise. It's a recognizable name that the franchise owners do have to pay a license for. On the other hand, it feels like a local coffee shop, anytime you go to one. And I think that's why, amidst all the competition, they've survived and they've done really well. I mean, there's been a lot of coffee shops around, even in our local area here in the Quad Cities, that have come and gone in the time the Dun Brothers has been there. And I think part of that staying power is the fact that they have the strength of that recognizable name, but then also the strength of the community aspect and the involvement there. It's really interesting when you go to the website, the Dun Brothers website. I'm talking about the main one, not like the small local one, but they have a page right up front that says like, do you want to own a coffee shop? And I was kind of shocked at the specificity of this is clearly directed toward like a business owner, someone who wants it. Said if you want to open one of our coffee shops, you have to have $100,000 in liquid assets and $500,000 in net worth. It costs, depending on where you live, it costs between $385,000 and $609,000 just to start it. That includes construction, startup costs, and the initial Dun Brothers license fee to have the name, which is $37,000. So, wow. You know, these are big numbers, but these are the kind of numbers that people who are serious about a coffee shop, would be interested to know. And it tells you right up front. You don't have to call. You don't have to get on some
recognizable name. Like exactly. Dun Brothers,
And also, just from a customer's point of view, people need to understand, the fact that you're able to go to a coffee shop, to go to a drive-thru, that isn't just Starbucks, but even like a more locally owned one. It's not cheap. It's extremely expensive to start anything in food and beverage. It's very expensive, and so it's just a nice thing to be able to have, and it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of, I think, valuable to be able to look under the hood every once in a while and realize, wow, someone really took a risk to, I mean, to start this place. Like, even if you have, you know, $1 million to lose, like, you still, no one wants to lose a bunch of money doing a coffee shop. So it is a risk to start something like that. They had all these details about like what, so in exchange for that license and everything, Dunn Brothers actually has a team that comes alongside you as a business owner and says, look, this is how, this is what we think would be a great business plan considering your locale. This is the kind of like demographic that, you know, if you're a coffee shop, you need to be in a place where people who like coffee shops live. And they talked about the reality of a lot of times they're in the same sort of vicinity or even strip mall as like a Panera or a Starbucks, which is their competition.
Right.
They even said they look for real estate that's facing the side of the street that morning traffic is near.
Oh, interesting.
Like, I just never thought of that. You know, like that you want to be.
I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah, because they close at 5 or 6, you know, they're not going for the going home traffic, but they're trying to catch, and coffee is just a morning thing.
Sure.
So trying to snag, do everything you can to get people who are on their way to work to say, oh, I think I'm going to get a cup of coffee and a breakfast sandwich or something.
I mean, that's very smart.
Yeah, and I was just, I've never seen on any website so far that kind of specific detail about like, hey, do you want to own a coffee shop? Like, here's how you can be a Dunn Brothers independent, franchise.
Yeah, just right
owner.
Up front, everything. Yeah.
So without further ado, let's taste this holiday blend.
Yeah, I'm excited to taste this holiday blend.
It's a blend of Ethiopia and Papua New Guinea.
Okay.
And here we go.
Do you know tasting notes for this?
I do.
Okay.
You get to guess.
All right.
It's a medium roast. All right, what do you think?
Oh, let's see. It's really good. I like it a lot.
It is good. I'm just looking at Alexi and she's really contemplating what she's tasting right now. It's not easy to do, especially when I'm looking at the...
All right, I'm going to say gingerbread men.
Final answer? Yeah. Men or not men?
Men.
You sound not sure about men.
I'm going to go with men.
Tasting notes on the 2020 edition of Dunn Brothers Coffee Holiday Blend is cherry, milk chocolate, and cedar. I've never seen type of tree.
No, I haven't either. Yeah. I was going to say chocolate, but I thought that was too easy.
Chocolate is honestly a pretty safe bet when guessing coffee tasting notes.
I guess it's gingerbread because it was holiday, so I thought I might, you know...
I don't think you're wrong.
I mean, I've never tasted a cedar tree, so...
Yeah, I've smelled cedar. But yeah, this is just a really good classic, you know, earthy holiday blend. They say that the Ethiopia side of the blend brings this wine kind of acidity and also the chocolate, whereas the Papua New Guinea brings... the body and the cedar and the kind of earthiness of it. So they bring those two, you know, Ethiopia's a little brighter, Papua New Guinea's a little darker.
I think it's very smooth.
Yeah.
And I mentioned this before that I usually drink coffee with cream.
You might be changing the way you drink coffee a little bit.
I don't know, but I'm drinking this black.
You are drinking this black.
It's very smooth. It's really good.
Yes.
So, yeah, I can kind of go either way, I guess,
depending
on the coffee.
Well, and like we always talk about, if it's higher quality coffee, it's way easier to drink without cream.
Right.
Yeah, so, hey, I mean, this is a really good, this reminds me of when I was working at Starbucks and they had the Christmas blend back when Starbucks was better. And and it was this kind of like earth, and I don't remember what kind of beans it was a combination of, but this is reminiscent of that for me when I was working at Starbucks in the late 2000s. And it's just that earthy. I know what you mean though about you almost taste in gingerbread, even if it's not there, you kind of taste like a spiciness or something. Gingerbread men. It was roasted on the 11th of December, so 2 days ago.
Oh, wow.
And again, right in keeping with the value of keeping things really fresh. I like the presentation. It's in this simple brown bag with the like a really clear, crisp logo right on the front. And then there's this pocket. There's this sort of band of paper that goes along the bottom in front of the bag. And there's this card tucked in to that strip that that gives the it's you know, it's kind of like the little
I've never seen that before
description
That's really
card
cool.
that says the process method, which this one is natural and washed, probably because it's two different beans. Says medium roast. It's just a really nice,
so they
crisp,
can use the same bag for everything, and then they just change
exactly.
out the card. That's really smart.
Yeah. Yep.
So very cool. Yep. Nice.
That's pretty much all I had to. That's pretty much everything I had to say about Dunn Brothers. Okay. Yeah, there's a couple there's a newer location in, I want to say, close to 53rd Street for anyone that lives in the Quad Cities, in sort of like a medical complex, I think, in the just north of 53rd Street in Davenport. And I've been there once. Really, really beautiful, cozy area. So yeah, they're doing good stuff, and just a really unique company because of the way that they emphasize franchise and local at the same time. And the roasting too. Mm-hmm. You know, it's even for locally owned coffee shops, it's kind of rare to have a roaster like right up front when you walk in the door.
Yeah.
So it's a cool thing as someone who's tried roasting, and I know how hard it is, and I know, you know, and how essential it is really to the, like, without a roaster somewhere, you don't have coffee, you don't
right.
have lattes, you don't have anything.
Yeah.
And so it's just neat that they
you
emphasize
can't
that.
Drink just raw coffee beans.
No, it's gross.
It would be terrible.
I chewed on one time. It was like eating grass. Yeah. Well, let me just double check my notes here. Okay. So yeah, on the website, it said Dunn Brothers partners with Fairtrade USA and Rainforest Alliance. Yeah, I guess that was just about everything that I was able to find on them. And so, great coffee. We'll keep drinking while we hear about this crime.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for doing all that research. And thank mm-hmm. you to Dunn Brothers for making such a delightful coffee. So, very good. Okay, so today on our 12th episode, yes?
Yes.
We are going to be talking about Marlene Lenberg. And to give you a clue about where in the world this crime comes from, I'm going to say that this crime is going to be hectic.
Okay. Oh, okay. I think
you
I
get
know.
It?
Yep.
Okay. It's coming from South Africa.
Okay.
Okay. So, and for those of you who don't know, hectic means crazy. In South African lingo, which is something we learned this past summer.
That's right.
From a South African friend that
yes,
we met.
That's so, right.
Yes. Okay. So Marlene Lenberg was born on October 13th, 1955 in Cape Town, South Africa, which is one of the largest cities. She was born to parents Arthur and Mavis, and her father Arthur was a high school dropout, and he married Mavis very young. So because of, you know, his lack of education and employment and everything, the family struggled financially for many years. And they lived with Arthur's parents in a garage on their property. Yeah. So they lived there for several years, and during that time they had five children, and Marlene was the youngest of those five children. So Arthur kind of had floundered around from job to job, you know, never really finding anything steady. But when Marlene was two, he finally found steady employment, and the family moved to a farm, a small farm near Cape Flats, which is kind of like just like a flat area of Cape Town. Makes
appropriately
sense.
Named.
Exactly. So a few years later, the family ended up moving to a suburb of Cape Town called Plumstead. And Marlene's parents were extremely religious, and as a child, her life revolved around a strict schedule of school and church activities. So she had a very, you know, like I said, her parents were very strict, and she kind of had sort of like a sad upbringing. So she was not allowed to have friends. She couldn't watch TV. She couldn't listen to any non-religious radio shows.
Not even friends from her church?
I don't think so. I think they just didn't want her hanging out with anybody. She couldn't listen to music, dance, go to the movies, wear makeup, anything like that. And a lot of, you know, I mean, a lot of people grow up with, you know, strict parents and have, you know, restrictions on what they can do. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But, you know, she was very isolated. She didn't have any friends. And then on top
of
that,
sounds like a cult.
Yeah. On top of that, her parents were very cold and unloving towards her. It, you know, her, especially her father. So she was a well-behaved child, and she maintained excellent grades in school, but they never showed her any affection, and they were very critical of her. So when she got to high school, she ended up getting very involved in church activities like the choir and teaching Sunday school in hopes of having some kind of a social life. And despite her being an excellent student, she ended up leaving school after grade 10 and decided to just get a job. And that was probably partially due to the fact that her parents never, you know, gave her any type of praise on how well she was doing or how good she was. So in February of 1972, at the age of 16, she joined the workforce and began a job as a receptionist at the Red Cross Children's Hospital in Rondebosch, Cape Town. So eventually she started working in the orthopedic workshop, where she met the chief technician, 45-year-old Christian van der Linde.
Okay.
So a little about Christian. He was a well-respected member of the community. He had been a longtime employee of the hospital. So Christian had been married to his wife, Susanna, for many years, and they had three children. He was a very warm and welcoming person, and Marlene immediately felt drawn to him. You know, growing up in a cold environment, you know, and then meeting this person who was almost like a father figure, showing her kindness, was really appealing to her. So the two became friends. They became close while working together. And despite Marlene now being only 17 and Christian being 46 and married, the two began an affair.
Wow. Has she been like estranged by her family at this
point? No, at this point, she still is living with her parents.
Okay, yeah. So they don't know about Christian.
No, definitely not.
Okay.
Oh, definitely not.
Okay.
So, yeah. So
but they were okay with her working this job?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, maybe the fact that they didn't necessarily have a lot of money.
Yeah.
It was kind of like, okay, yeah.
That'll do it. Yeah.
Get a job.
Was she giving money to them?
I'm not sure. I don't know. But maybe, you know, because she was making money, she was just able to kind of like take care of herself, and that lifted some of the burden off of her parents.
Okay.
I'm not sure. But so, yeah. So they began an affair in the spring of 1973.
Okay.
So the two would leave work together, and they would go to a place called Pardon Eland and Rondebosch Common. And Rondebosch Common was kind of just like an open field. And they would go there and just like hang out together and spend time together.
Right.
And they would often meet there in secret as well. So shortly after Marlene turned 18 in October of 1973, she ended up moving out of her parents' home.
Okay.
And she moved into a boarding house. So at that point, she and Christian had much more freedom to see each other, which they took full advantage of. They spent many evenings together, et cetera, et cetera. So in the beginning of 1974, Christian's wife began getting anonymous phone calls telling her about her husband's infidelity. And when she asked Christian about it, he was just like, oh, it's just a prank call. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, this stuff happens to everyone.
But at this point, he was afraid that she was going to find out that it was true. Yeah. So he stopped the affair with Marlene.
Okay.
And, you know, as you can imagine, Marlene was none too pleased about this. So she had hoped that Christian would eventually leave his wife and the two would get married and live happily ever after. And now her hopes were dashed. So she decided that the only thing in the way between her and getting the man of her dreams was his pesky wife, Susanna. So throughout most of the year, Marlene and Christian still worked together. They continued to see each other, although far less frequently because Christian was, you know.
So he really did cut it off. Like
he did, stopped. Yeah. But yeah. I mean, they were still kind of in, you know, doing their thing. Just like probably sneakier, not as often, that kind of thing. Because, you know, at this point, he's afraid his wife's going to find out.
Yeah.
You know, he, even though he's having this affair with Marlene, he does love his wife. I guess. He's got these kids, so he doesn't want to break up the family, all that stuff. So in July of 1974, Marlene decided to give Christian an ultimatum, either leave his wife or she would leave Cape Town forever and he would never see her again.
Wow.
So he didn't end up leaving his wife and she didn't leave Cape Town. So in September, she decided to take matters into her own hands and call Susanna to arrange for the two of them to meet. So Susanna agreed to meet with her, and she told Susanna that her and Christian were, you know, seeing each other, that they were very much in love, and that she wanted Susanna basically to get out of the way and let her continue having this, you know, love affair with her husband. So now at this point, his wife had already had her suspicions about the fact that they had been having an affair. And her response to this was pretty surprising. So she told Marlene that she didn't mind playing second fiddle as long as Marlene didn't mind either.
Weird.
Yeah.
What?
So Marlene wasn't down for that. You know, she wanted to be Christian's one and only.
Yeah.
So she made a plan B. And you can only imagine.
Is that where the crime comes in?
Yes. So several months before Marlene contacted her lover's wife, she had met a man at the orthopedic clinic who had lost a leg in a car accident and was getting fitted for a prosthetic leg. He was 33-year-old Martinus Charles Chuhu.
And this how do you spell Chuhu?
Okay, it's, and I had to like look this up because it's spelled Choegoe.
Okay, so the G sounds like an H.
Yeah, and weird. And Martinus is spelled Martinus.
Ah, but the okay.
So it's a very confusing name.
Yeah,
I've never heard of that last name Chuhu.
I never have either.
It's kind of fun. I like
yeah,
it.
Yeah, Chuhu. Chuhu.
Chuhu. Okay, so after Martinus's accident, he suffered greatly. Not only had he lost a leg and had many other lasting injuries, he had also lost his job, and everything had taken an immense toll on his mental well-being, mm-hmm. as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. So over the months, Marlene had taken the opportunity to befriend him. She was an attractive young woman, and he took quite the liking to her. Hmm. You know, she would kind of flirt with him. Hey, Martinus, how you doing today? In early October, Marlene sent a letter to Martinus asking him to come see her at work and that she had an opportunity for him to make good money.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. So
what could go wrong with that?
Nothing. I don't see anything going wrong with this. So once he showed up at her work, she gave him one South African rand, which is like their currency.
Okay.
And I looked it up, and it's less than like 70 cents.
Okay.
I don't know if that's right. Any South African friends that are listening, maybe you can help us out.
Was it like a down payment for something?
Well, it was like $1.
$1.
It was less than $1.
But what was this payment for?
So she gave it to him and was like, hey, meet me later. Here's $1. I don't know. I guess to like entice him into like meeting her later.
Okay.
But that's not very much money.
Yeah.
But maybe to him it was because he didn't have a job and I don't know. Anyway.
Maybe it was like more of a flirtatious thing or something.
Here's $1, Martinus. So she told him to meet her later at the Rondebosch Town Hall. And when she met him that evening, she gave him a bottle of gin and said, I want you to murder a woman for me. And there's more where that came from.
This guy doesn't have a leg, right?
Right.
Hmm.
Yeah. I mean,
doesn't seem like the choice to hire.
That's
like
kind of what I was thinking.
Yeah, but.
But I think that the fact that he was, you know, unemployed, he didn't have any money, he was kind of like down on his luck.
Yeah.
He seemed like an easy target for her. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So she gives him a bottle of gin and says, hey, like, will you murder this woman for me? And he says no.
Okay. Did he take the gin anyway?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he did. Unless she took it back. I don't know. So over several days, Marlene remained in touch with Martinus, trying to convince him to do her a solid. Like, hey, Martinus, I gave you this bottle of gin. I gave you $1.
Be
like,
a pal.
Come on, man.
Yeah.
So finally he agreed, and a few days later, he went to Susanna's house. He was planning on telling her that Marlene was planning to kill her. So he goes to her house, and he's actually going to, like, tell her what's going on. Yeah. That's what he says. He ends up chickening out, though, and when he got there, he just asked her for some money. So he goes to Christian's house, His wife is there. He asks her for money. Okay. So she says no, she doesn't have any money, and she, you know, sends him away. So later that week, Marlene requested to meet with Martinus again, and this time she gave him a radio and told him that she would make sure that he got a new leg if he committed the murder.
Whoa.
I mean, was the stakes are getting higher and higher.
The leg
here.
Of the person he was going to kill?
No, that's hilarious. No,
I. A woman's leg.
She was promising him that she would like put a like a rush order on this prosthetic leg.
Oh, okay.
I mean, what more do you need in this life besides, you know, a bottle of gin,
and
a transistor radio, and two functional legs?
Yeah.
I mean, really?
Yep, that's all someone could ever want.
So he said he would at this point.
Okay.
But then he ended up not being able to go through with it.
Oh, wow.
I think
she picked the wrong guy to murder her.
I mean, her target. Yeah, yeah. Also,
I think if someone showed up at my door with no leg asking for money, I would give them some money.
I mean, I think so. Yeah, I mean, how could you really say no?
Yeah. How did he get around?
I'm assuming maybe he had some sort of a, like a crutch
or something.
Yeah. So she continued to try to persuade him, and this time she promised him a car and that she would get with him.
Whoa.
Yeah. This reminds me of like The Price is Right or something.
Yeah, it feels like a game
keeps,
show.
Like, upping.
And the third time is like everything you ever dreamed of.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
I mean, if he had done it the first time, he only would have gotten like a dollar and a bottle of gin.
So he's milking it at this
point. Now he's
going
to get a dollar, a bottle of gin, a radio, a leg, a car, and like a girlfriend. So apparently, this time she made him an offer that he couldn't refuse. So on October 24th, Marlene picked up Martinus and drove him to the Van der Linde home. And the only weapon he had on him was a hammer, which is like, ugh.
Yeah, it's messy.
Yeah. So she drops him off and then she just like pieces out. So Susanna saw him and she thought it was suspicious because she had obviously seen him creeping around before, you know, he had come to her house and asked for money.
Yep.
So she called the police. So the police came and they took him downtown and they beat him and told him that he better never return to the area. It's kind of mean to beat up a one-legged man.
Yeah.
He didn't even do anything at this point.
Yeah.
But I guess he was just, you know, they were afraid. I don't know. I mean, this was probably a nice neighborhood. The husband's a doctor.
Yeah. Oh,
and like,
right.
I don't know. So at this point, Marlene is pretty PO'd. So she moves on to a new hitman. So she had a friend. She had kind of befriended this guy named Rob Newman who lived in her boarding house. He was a college student. And she knew that he had a pistol. So she asked him if
Why didn't she talk to him at first? Why did she go so far with this
other
guy?
I guess she felt like the original guy had like less to lose.
Oh.
And maybe Rob Newman would have been less likely to do it.
Yeah, had a promising future.
Right. I mean, he was an engineering student, you know. So she asked him if she could borrow his pistol, and he's like, no. Nope. So she's like, okay.
That's an interesting transformation she's making from like clearly wanting to kill someone but not having the courage to, and
right,
trying to hire someone else, to now she is willing to do it herself. She's going
right
through this progression of,
and
like,
now she's like telling all kinds of people about it.
Right.
Which is never a good idea. If you know anything about crime, the less people that know about it, the better.
Yeah.
Have
we ever talked about this on the show before about how kind of messed up it feels when you're watching like Forensic Files or something like that, and you're like, no, dummy, do it this way so you can get away with it.
I don't know if
we
have talked about that, but I think about that all the time.
It's a very common thing.
Whenever I watch any shows like that, I'm always like thinking about how could they have done it where they wouldn't have gotten
caught. You could have gotten away with it if you just...
Let us know if anybody else has those thoughts.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. You guys listen to the show. You have to think those thoughts.
I mean, I would like to think we're not the only ones that think about that kind of stuff.
Right.
So he says, no, she can't borrow his gun.
Okay.
So she's like, well, okay, if I can't borrow your gun, then will you kill somebody for me, please?
Please. I'll do anything.
And of course, he tells her no.
Yeah.
Like, you're crazy. So on October 28th.
But he doesn't call the police or anything.
Okay.
Her.
So he does eventually.
Oh, okay.
So on October 28th, Rob reported his gun had been stolen.
Okay.
So he doesn't say anything right away, but a couple days later, when his gun is stolen, he reports it to the police.
Okay.
And then
how did
she
get in his room and steal his gun?
He lived in a boarding house, so I don't know if maybe
there was like a key for every door.
Yeah, or maybe the doors didn't lock. Maybe,
yeah.
I don't know.
Okay.
So, and he told the police that Marlene may have done it. Because he tells her about this conversation that he has with her. And but nothing really came of it. It doesn't really seem like they looked into it at that point. They're like, Marlene wouldn't do that. She's such a sweet, pretty girl. So on the morning of November 4th, Marlene went to Martinez's house. So Rob's not into it. So she's like, I'm going to give this another try with Martinez. And she tells him that she's going to be moving to Johannesburg and she wants to go and say goodbye to Christian. And she wants him to come with her.
Okay.
So he gets in her car and she hands him the pistol that she stole from Rob and tells him, like, now is the time. Like, we're going to do this.
Uh-oh.
So he goes with her to the house and Marlene goes up. They get out of the car. Marlene rings the doorbell to distract Susanna while Martinez went around the house and entered through the back door. So Susanna opens the door for Marlene because... Oh, hey, it's my husband's mistress.
Yeah, why not?
Hey, girl, what's going on? So Marlene enters the home. And then when Susanna saw Martinez, she got freaked out. Because she's like, oh, my gosh, there's that creepy guy again.
Yeah.
So she tried to run to the phone to call the police. And while she was running, Marlene tripped her and she fell. And Marlene took this opportunity to hit her on the head with the pistol. So I don't know if Marlene doesn't know how guns work.
I think Marlene doesn't have a killer instinct. Like she wants to murder this woman, but she just, it's really hard for her. Like, cause we do stories about other people. It's like murder is just natural for them.
Yeah.
Like they don't even have any, but she clearly has an issue with it.
Right.
Like there's a repulsion
against
it.
She can't like fully like bring yourself to do it.
Which is a great quality in anyone.
I mean, yeah.
As long as, yeah.
So, but then she handed Martinez a pair of scissors and told him to stab Susanna.
How is that better than shooting her?
Ugh. I don't know. You go
bunch
to
of
the,
blood everywhere.
You go to all the trouble to steal this gun.
Yeah, that's so weird. What a mess.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't respect how this murder was done.
This is not a respectful murder.
Mm-mm.
She tells Martinez to stab her, which he does several times.
Where?
In the chest.
Oof.
Yeah. So once they were sure that she was...
Like from the front or from the back?
I think it was from the front.
Okay.
But that's a good question. I'm not 100%
sure. Because
she
had tripped.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, maybe.
So
no, because that would have been in her back then.
It would still reach your heart if the scissors were long enough. Anyway.
I think it was her front, though.
Okay.
So when they were sure that... Susanna was dead. Marlene then found a gas pistol. Do you know what that is?
Have
you ever heard of that?
Guess I don't, but have you ever seen No Country for Old Men?
No.
There's this guy that goes around. It's really interesting. It's a Coen Brothers movie, so it's, you know, it's kind of a little avant-garde, but I think this actually existed. It's a cattle, or no, it's like a CO2 tank, I think, that... But like whatever the pressure was, extremely high pressure inside this canister.
Yeah.
And this guy would walk around, really weird character, and he would shoot people with this tank but he had little lead pieces like in the tube, and he somehow had a way of really, he would actually use this to like, it was so strong, he could put it against a lock in a door, like a deadbolt.
Yeah.
And it would just shoot it right through. He could get it through any door.
Whoa.
And so he's this predatory, creepy guy who goes around with it. And so he's carrying this tank with him all the time, which people think is for his health.
Oh,
and he has this really bad limp.
It's like an oxygen tank or something?
So no one is suspicious.
Yeah.
But all the while he's going around shooting people and getting into rooms with this like tank of air that has somehow has like a bullet like, you know... contraption on the end of it.
Does he kill people with this?
He does. He puts it. I know he shoots someone right in the head one time, and it's like a bullet. I mean, it just killed him. So I'm wondering if that's the actual name for it, or not.
It could be. So I looked it up, and it was a little confusing. So when I looked it up, it said that it was a non-lethal weapon, but I think that what you're talking about, it's probably the same thing, just like a different kind.
Yeah.
Because this apparently shot out green dye.
Okay.
So like for a paintball gun.
Well, maybe it was for a cattle, like marking cattle or something like that.
Yeah, that could be. So Marlene finds this gas pistol and she shoots Martinus with it and covers him in green dye. And then she tells him, so you can't tell anybody about this and you can't go to the police because I just marked you and they're going to know
what about my car?
They're going to know that
dude,
you did
where's
this.
My car?
Yeah, where's my car? Where's my girlfriend? Where's my leg?
Yeah.
What's going on? Okay, so they left and they go home.
Okay.
So later that day, after being unable to get a hold of his wife, Christian asks his daughter, who worked nearby, to go home at lunchtime and check on her mother. So she goes home, and that's when she finds her laying on the living room floor.
Hmm.
So obviously she calls the police. And later when Christian arrived at the home to identify his wife, they said that he seemed very cold and uncaring.
Hmm.
And at first they actually suspected him that he was involved in this, but he was never charged. Nothing ever came of it.
Okay. Were any of their kids around when the murder happened?
No, they were. This one daughter was at work. I don't know how old the other kids were, but maybe they were at school or something because it happened like in the morning.
Okay.
So they immediately suspected Martinus because he had been seen, you know, creeping around the neighborhood before.
Yeah.
But they were having trouble.
And he was green.
Yeah. We're looking for a green man running around town. But they were having trouble finding him because he was essentially homeless at this point. Mm. He was kind of just like bouncing around to wherever. Mm. So about a week later, on November 13th, during their investigation, they started questioning people at the hospital where Christian and Marlene worked. So coworkers told them about the affair. And so then they started to think, well, maybe this girl is involved. So they end up bringing Marlene in for questioning. And during questioning, Marlene admitted that she had been having an affair with Christian, but denied even knowing who Martinus Chuhu was.
Okay.
So they asked her if she knew him. She denied it. They also asked her about the comments that she had made to Rob Newman about wanting him to kill Susanna. And she said she said that, but she was just joking.
Course.
Yeah. Haha. So eventually, as questioning became more intense, she broke down and told police that she had, in fact, driven Martinus to the Van der Linde home, dropped him off, and then came back later to pick him up. So at this point, she was arrested after admitting her involvement in this. So soon after this, they end up locating Martinus, and he was arrested as well. And he's green, so they know it's him.
Yeah, pretty easy.
So this case was highly publicized, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
So, you know, this case has everything.
Right.
Murder, mayhem, a love affair,
yep.
A one-legged man, a beautiful woman. You know, it's just media gold. So Marlene and Martinus were actually tried together, which is unusual.
Oh, that is unusual.
Yeah, and I have heard of that occasionally happening, even
such
in the
odd couple.
U.S., but it's unusual. So the trial began on March 5th, 1975, about 5 months after the murder. And during the trial, Marlene never admitted to taking an active role in the murder, only dropping Martinus off, ringing the doorbell, and picking him up after the deed was done. However, Martinus told the court that Marlene had been there and assisted in the murder.
Which is easier to believe if he's got one leg. I mean,
right.
If he's on crutches, like he can't be like tripping someone and stabbing
him
at the same time.
Yeah, it would
time.
Be very difficult.
Yeah, it would be.
So his story was corroborated by a witness, a neighbor of the Van der Lindes, who said that she had seen Marlene's white Ford Anglia, which I've never heard of before. Must not have been a car sold in the U.S.
Yeah.
She had seen her car parked outside for several minutes with no one inside the vehicle.
Okay.
So, you know, obviously,
yep.
Marlene.
Gun.
Yep, exactly. Smoking Anglia. So about 30 other witnesses testified during the week-long trial, and on March 13th, after an overnight deliberation, the judge found them both guilty of murder.
Wow. Do they have degrees there in South Africa, or is it just murder or not?
First
degree, second degree?
You know, I don't know. That's a good question. I should have looked that up. It didn't say.
Okay.
So I'm assuming maybe it was just...
Regular old murder, classic.
And they were both sentenced to death by hanging.
Whoa,
which is pretty old school.
That is,
and this is in
75.
Yeah, I don't.
Wow.
I mean, I don't think they were still hanging people in the U.S. in the 70s.
No, it might have technically been in a law somewhere, but I don't think it was going on
right
in the 1970s.
Wow, that's crazy.
So, did they get hanged?
Well. They both ended up appealing their sentences.
Okay.
So later that year, that July, they appealed their sentences, and their sentences were actually both commuted. So 20 years in prison for Marlene and just 15 years in prison for Martinus.
Okay.
So oddly, during this time, Christian told Marlene that he would be there for her and that he would visit her in prison, but he never actually visited her.
Oh, wow.
So... he was like, see ya. And he moved on.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he was never implicated in anything.
No, he never was. And I don't think he was ever involved.
Yeah.
Because I think if he was, Marlene probably would have said or something. But
I wonder if like infidelity was a crime at that point, if hanging was still...
It might have been, like you said, it might have been on the books
somewhere.
Yeah. But yeah, he was never charged with anything. So 11 years later in 1986, both Martinus and Marlene were released from prison. So neither one of them served their full sentences. They served, 11 years. And Martinus actually went on to become an evangelical preacher.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but he ended up dying just 6 years later in 1992 in a car accident.
Okay.
So,
was he like a famous preacher, like a televangelist or something?
I don't think so.
Okay.
He was probably just like a local preacher.
Was he itinerant or like, did he have a church that he...
I don't know. Okay. These are all very good questions.
And then what did she do?
So once she was released, she was about 30 years old when she was released from prison. She went on to attend university. Where she studied...
She picked right back up.
She did. Picked right up where she left off. She studied computer science, music, and finance, and eventually earned a degree in psychology. She also maintained a 9-year relationship with a fellow former inmate named Jennifer Westfall. Eventually, it didn't work out.
Okay.
But and after graduating with her degree, Marlene opened a beauty salon and joined a modeling agency. So she's, just living life.
Wow.
So over the years, she began to suffer from several debilitating conditions, including osteoporosis and breast cancer. And on October 7th, 2015, just a few days before her 60th birthday, Marlene committed suicide.
Wow.
So...
Why did she commit suicide?
Because she was dealing with a lot of health problems and she was in a lot of pain.
Okay. How did she do it?
I don't know. It didn't say, but I wonder if part of that too was just maybe like the guilt of this had been like following her around.
Yeah, because clearly from the beginning she like we were talking about, she wasn't like what do you call it, have that quality of like psychosis in some of these other cases where they just like have no regret or restraint about it at all.
Right.
She had this like...
No, she was like...
pervasive restraint about it. So she probably did deal with a ton of guilt.
Right. Yeah. I'm assuming. I mean, she went on to live a very productive life.
Right.
After she was released, which is kind of surprising.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, in the end, she just, couldn't go on.
Wow.
So yeah. So that's the story of Marlene... Lindbergh.
Marlene Lindbergh from South Africa, Cape Town.
That was hectic.
That was hectic.
Do you have any questions? Comments?
No,
concerns?
I think you covered everything.
Okay, yeah. Very good. Yeah, and I had never heard of this case before I started,
Is this in your book?
It actually was not.
Oh.
No, so I found... I don't even remember where I found this. But I had never seen it, like, on, a crime show or anything. I mean, I'm sure it is somewhere, but it's an interesting case.
Yeah, very
definitely
interesting.
Like, you know, has a lot of crazy elements to it.
Yeah, it does. It's got, I thought the murder was going to happen a lot quicker than it did. There were all these misgivings and pivots and changes to the plan. And the poor woman also almost survived just because of the buffoonery of the process of trying to kill her. And honestly, I mean, Christian should have done more to protect. Like,
well, yeah,
she should have seen this coming, I think. But
yeah, I think so too. I think he, like, when he heard that his wife had died, it was almost like he wasn't too surprised.
Right. Yeah.
So that's, it's like
kind of messed up.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. So there is our crime.
There's our crime. And Dunn Brothers coffee is what we were tasting today. And the holiday blend was really good and chocolatey and tasted to Alexi like gingerbread men.
Men.
And
gingerbread men.
And thank you for listening, everybody. Have a very Merry Christmas.
Yes. Are we going to be...
We'll probably do one more.
Okay, yeah. So not yet.
In case we don't talk to you before then, or you...
you listen...
Just, we just want to wish you a Merry Christmas.
Yes, Merry Christmas. And we will probably be back next week.
Yes.
We'll see how things go.
Yeah, I've got a coffee on the way from California.
Oh, okay. So we have to.
We have. So we have no choice.
All right. Well, thank you guys for listening. Thank you for getting us to 3,000 listens. Mm-hmm. That's huge.
Yep. And as always,
we will take our coffee
with crime.
See you next time.